Welcome to Banking Reinvented, Commercial Banking Takeover. This limited series goes straight to the front lines of commercial banking. I'm Alex Jimenez, and in each episode, I'll be speaking with industry leaders about the bold shifts transforming the sector from rewiring relationship management to modernizing trade finance, payments, and onboarding. Powered by Backbase Unlock Growth Mode movement, these conversations pull back the curtain on what it takes to move from maintenance to momentum.
Welcome to Banking Reinvented, Unlock Growth Mode. I'm Alex Jimenez, and today I'm joined by someone who's been helping financial institutions punch above their weight for decades, JP Nichols, who, by the way, is also a good friend of mine. So if you know fintech, you probably read his work, you've heard him breaking banks, or seen his frameworks in action through ILO Labs. JP, how are you doing?
Great to see you, Alex. It's been far too long.
So let's just start with just a warm-up question. So you work with banks of all sizes. What's one thing mid-size and community banks still get wrong about innovation?
Probably the top thing is that banks of all sizes, and I think even the big ones are guilty of this, they often confuse motion with progress. So there's a lot of stuff going on, right? People are busy. It's not like the old days of 363. Right? You pay 3% for deposits, lend it back out at 6%, and you're on the golf course by 3 p.m. People are working hard. They're doing things. And, you know, sometimes it's the business as usual that gets caught up. And sometimes there's some intention to try to be more innovative. And they do things like, you know, hackathons, or as my partner Jason Hendricks likes to call it, the fintech petting zoo. But all of those things aren't necessarily leading to progress.
You've called out irrelevance risk as the biggest threat to banks today. What does that look like in commercial banking specifically?
Yeah, I think it's all parts of the bank, but we have been paying kind of special attention to the commercial side of the bank lately. It has felt like too many of the bankers have felt that that was untouchable. Well, we understand that the consumers want this digital stuff, right? And we can't compete with JP Morgan Chase or Capital One or whoever. But our bread and butter is that, you know, small to mid-size local business, we've got local relationships and so on. And the reality is those businesses are owned and run by the same human beings who are expecting digital banking because they're watching digital entertainment and ordering things at the touch of a button. And we're seeing that the tech platforms are very quickly moving upfield. Square reported in their fourth quarter earnings report that their average customer that's using their banking partners is averaging $35,000 in deposits. That's nothing to sneeze at. They also reported that they are very happy and will continue to focus on moving up market. And that part of their business is growing 24% year over year. So it's not just the Etsy sellers and the food trucks anymore. They are, you know, coming for your middle market customers, the manufacturers, maybe not the manufacturers if they're not doing any kind of retail sale because they're mostly focused on the point of sale, but they're digging beyond just accepting the payments, and they're offering merchant cash advances and a lot more detail around that. And it's coming up very quickly. So I'm worried that not enough banks are paying attention to that. And at the end of the day, the biggest risk of all is that they're just irrelevant.
A head of commercial at a bank where I worked used to love to say that commercial banking was shoe leather business. It was a handshake. It was face-to-face. And digital was totally immaterial. But what we are seeing is that their children are now inheriting the companies. They're expecting a different level of digital. How much of that is driving the desire to present yourself better as a bank in the digital space?
Yeah, I think that is definitely part of it. But even the old folks like myself, I mean, we're adopters of digital technology. We want to make life easier. We don't want to spend time shuffling papers and going off to see the banker, even when we do have a good relationship. I mean, the thing I want to be clear about is it's not that they're lying. They really do have good relationships with these customers, and the customers do appreciate them. The question is, do they appreciate them enough to stay with it? Yes, we love Alex, our commercial banker, but is that enough to alone to put off some of these things? The Fed had a survey, 68% of what they called small businesses. So that's a big question is, well, how are we defining that and where? But I think increasingly that question is becoming more and more moot, right? The line between what we might traditionally call small business and more middle market is getting thinner and grayer all the time. But nonetheless, the Fed survey said 68% are using non-bank financial services, and another 24% said they expect to increase that going forward. So I get that the relationships are important, and it's not either or. It's how do you empower those relationship managers to have better tools to create better customer experiences, get the jobs done for the customers, and really reserve the time for those relationships to take place in a way that is adding real value, right? If they want to talk to an expert, and this is what the banks say, well, they want to talk to me. Okay, fine. But what they don't want to do is talk to you about getting something done over an hour that could have been done in 5 minutes digitally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So your team in Alloy Labs has created really an unfair advantage for nearly 100 banks. What recurring challenges do you see across them when it comes to scaling commercial growth?
Yeah, it is a challenge. We're still in the early stage. Number one is just behavior change. I've been relaying an Upton Sinclair quote a lot lately. He says it's difficult to convince a man of something when his salary depends on him not understanding it, right? When we think our job is to shuffle these papers around and to calculate these ratios in a spreadsheet, it takes a while to really understand that transition and to be able to leverage the technology. And very much related to that, one of the things we've been uncovering in our research and in interviews lately is incentives. And both capital I incentives, meaning, you know, cash incentives and bonus plans and so on, but also just those subtle small I incentives, just what are the things that we're paying attention to and reward, what are the things that we're ignoring or punishing. And we really are still holding people accountable for doing things that are better done by technology. And we need to rethink the way that we're encouraging people to spend their time. And it really should be with those things that only humans can do.
So you developed the FIRE process. I love that. The fast, iterative, responsive experiments. Can you walk us through how a commercial team could apply that to improve onboarding or trade finance or treasury management?
Yeah, sure. So it is an acronym, as you described. So the first word is FAST. It's about reducing the time between ideas and results. And often the most important component of that is reducing the time between talk and action. So try something, anything. So instead of thinking about months or quarters or years of implementation, test a new idea. Think in terms of weeks. And so if that is, trade finance, maybe there's a new digitized form of LC. And I know there's a lot of talk of smart contracts and blockchains. We're still pretty early in those things, but there's lots of things that we can do before we even get all the way down that road to just test some things. Iterative means we'll start with one frequent customer that has been using this a lot and pay attention to what they do and what they say. And they had, are there workarounds that maybe you didn't notice? The I is iterative. So test and learn. Responsive means use the data that you're getting from those interactions, from any transactional data that you have, to change the future iterations and to set up the experiments. The last word, E, is experiments. So, test one thing and test and learn. If you already know what the answer is, it isn't a test. And so just being able to work through those iteration loops faster, that's what the competitors are doing. That's what's really making the difference.
Yeah. So having been at banks, we always talked about being fast followers, which really meant we were just followers. And and we were not doing any of the things that you just mentioned. So what's an example of a commercial banking client who uses strategic fintech partnerships, not just for PR, but for real growth?
Yeah. So first of all, to your other point, you've probably heard me joke about this over the years. Everybody says we're fast followers, and I usually say, well, you're half right. And there's nothing fast about what you're doing, but you're definitely a follower. So there's that. And if you think about what does that mean, and there are a lot of bankers that say, well, darn right, I'm very proud of that because we want to, you know, make sure that other people are making the mistakes. And if that's what you're really doing, then that is smart. But just sitting back and pointing and saying, well, you know, that other thing didn't work, so we're just going to keep doing what we've done for the last 40 years. Well, I'm not so sure that's really a very smart strategy. So on the commercial side, you know, we're still pretty early. Mostly what we're seeing now is a focus on the digital onboarding. And so on both sides, both deposit accounts and loan applications, and trying to take some of the friction out of that process. As you know, a commercial account, whether it's a loan or even a deposit, just requires a whole lot more due diligence and paperwork than a consumer. So we're seeing a lot of focus on the front end, which makes sense. But I'm excited to get kind of beyond that and really think about those jobs to be done. Because when we look at what is happening and where the risks and where the opportunities are, I mentioned Square, for instance, but you know, Mercury and Brex and Meow, there are all of these new fintechs that are focused on small businesses, and they're coming in with a single focus on, you know, whether that's payments or ramp with employee reimbursements, but they're quickly expanding that. And so the banks don't have a lot of time to just focus on just the onboarding piece. They really need to move to the getting jobs done piece. I would say where we've seen the most success so far is those that haven't been afraid to put a little bit of focus around a vertical. We've seen a lot around professional services, so law firms and medical practices. You know, once you get into medical payments, there are a whole bunch of things that get far outside of the scope of banking with insurance reimbursements and all that. But there's a lot of complications around receiving those payments. And once you start digging into that, you can really understand how to customize it. You know, we've seen, I'll go off field for just a quick second to tell you on the consumer side, one of the stories we're most proud of is we found a fintech company called Careful. They built an AI engine to detect and prevent senior fraud and abuse. So there's you know, $9 billion a year in senior fraud and abuse. 45 million of us become unknown, unexpected, untrained caregivers for our older parents. I went through it twice with each of my parents, 2,500 miles away. But they had never sold to or through banks before. And we brought them into our concept lab, worked with the way we solve the problem, how do we market that, what is the bank's role in that. And they're live with, oh, I don't know, a couple of dozen institutions right now. And what we found through that process is it's not just solving that specific problem or doing that job. Is over time, if you do that really well, not only does that solve the problem, it creates better retention, and it even becomes a customer acquisition tool. So we're a little bit mature into that one now. So we have customers coming into the banks and saying, hey, I want that account where I can look after my mom's account, right? I'd say most of the banks aren't there yet. The big banks, you know, Wells Fargo has done a lot around their CEO platform and all of that. And I think most of the community and mid-sized banks are still catching up, but they need to do so pretty quickly because there's really a lot more than just easing the trip through the front door.
I'm going to set you up with this question, but what's a time when a bank tried to innovate but fell short, and what did they miss?
Yeah. I have a hard time picking just one. Alex, what I'd say is couple of things. Maybe the first one is they often tend to confuse process improvements with value improvement for the customer. So they'll think about something that's internal, and that's fine, that's fair, that's legitimate to say, hey, our back office underwriters are spending 20 hours a week on this process, and we think with automation we can get it down to 4. That's great, but unless that translates into something that the customer values, it's probably not going to show up on your bottom line. So you've heard me talk before about, we talk about extending the line, bending the line, transcending the line, right? Extending the line is just keep doing what we've always been doing. And for most of the industry, that's low to mid single digits. And so it's probably aiming too low. In other words, we improve a few little things and then sit back and go, wow, my business is going to explode. And it didn't really impact it much. We're still growing at low to mid single digits. If you want to bend the line or transcend the line, you've really got to focus on solving a problem for customers. Part of that is, if you think of the holy trinity of design thinking, is about the technology, the people, and the business. Banks tend to spend so much time on the technology piece. And I get it. Look, it has to work. It has to be compliant. The due diligence is really, really important. But if instead you flip that and spend a little bit more time up front on, does this solve a problem for my customer? Then that's what we like to call avoid the droid, the dreaded ROI discussion, right? We don't know how to move forward because we don't know what the ROI is. Well, no, because you're not improving anything for any customers. And if you can kind of test that early, and you don't have to spend a whole bunch of money and a whole bunch of time doing that, you can take a lightweight prototype and go talk to some customers and find out, oh yeah, that makes my life a whole lot easier, or even better. No, that's not my problem. My problem is this other thing over here. And now you've uncovered something you didn't even know about. And maybe your competitors don't either, right? So if it's really trying to focus on that, because let's go back to where we started, irrelevance risk. I mean, the biggest risks that banks are really facing that are overlooked or underappreciated is, number one, adoption risk, right? What if I spend all this time and all this money in this fintech partnership, have all these meetings, all this angst, all these board reports, and find out customers couldn't care less, right? And I've been there before, you've been there before, probably most of the listeners have been there before. And how to avoid that is by spending a little bit more time on making sure we're really clear on what problem we're solving for the customers. And then related to that is disruption risk, right? The fact that your competitors are going to solve this problem in a good enough way before you do, and good enough sometimes is good enough. So it's really those risks, and we tend to get, I say we as bankers, you and I are both recovering bankers, we tend to really think so much about the internal requirements, and all those are important. I don't mean to minimize those, but we need to prioritize the customer needs. And then, yes, all those other things need to make sense too.
Something you said earlier, just do something, right? Sometimes bankers will say, unless I know it's going to work, I'm not going to try it, right? I remember many years ago, I was having my annual review with my boss. And at that point, I headed innovation at a bank. And the question that she asked me, you know, tell me about what successes you had this year. And number one, I named something that didn't work out. And she said, I was not a success. That didn't work. We had to pivot and move away from it. And I said, yes, but the success was the fact that we learn a lot from it. We also realized that where we were going was the wrong way, and we would have lost a lot of money if we had gone down that path. She disagreed with me. Many years later, she said that she actually had thought about that for a while and had eventually agreed with me. By then, she was no longer my boss, so... So how do you help banks shift from innovation theater, right? You talk about a lot about that, to actually innovation performance.
Well, what you just shared there in your story speaks to the small I incentives, right? You know, how was she thinking about measuring your performance? How was she going to have her discussion with you about your annual performance, the state of mind that she had? And it's normal, right? As bankers, we're used to being right 99.something% of the time, because the number one thing we do is manage our credit book. And if we get that wrong more than 1.something% of the time over the long run, due to the leveraged nature of our balance sheet, we're out of business, right? But that doesn't apply to everything. Or I sometimes call that, you know, that's 3 or 4 sigma, not quite 6 sigma. I hope 6 sigma is the way we're running our network uptime and all of that. But when we're innovating, what we're really looking for is 1 sigma. And that means there's about a 2 in 3 chance that this is probably the right thing. And kind of related to that, there are two concepts maybe I'll say at once because they're related. And the other is when we talk about ROI and the droid, avoid the droid, the dreaded ROI discussion. The whole trick to this is not trying to more carefully calculate the R, the return. It's on minimizing the I, making the cost of failure acceptable. Now, to your story, if you learned that lesson quickly and relatively cheaply, and like you said, we would have lost a whole lot more money if we would have kept going on this, that reframes the whole conversation and the way that we're thinking about this and measuring this, right? That if the I is really minimal, hey, I spent 2 weeks and $500 in T&E because I went out and talked to a dozen customers to really deeply understand what problem they're trying to solve, and the thing we're working on isn't it, that is an absolute success, because you and I both know plenty of examples of banks that didn't take that step. So they spent hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, and months of time, and not just financial resources, but managerial time and attention. And so, you know, minimizing that is a really important step to making sure that you're getting to value. And then that kind of takes us back to what are the things that we're measuring. And when we are trying up front, you know, we want to say, hey, if 2 out of 3 customers tell us this is a pretty good idea, we know we're on the right track. That doesn't mean you go from there to full on launch, let's sign the 10-year contract and go all in with this, right? I always like to say launch date is the 50-yard line. Right? There's a lot of work to get there, but just saying, okay, we launched, it's out there. A bank you may know, several years ago we worked with, they did an upgrade on their mobile banking platform. They were an early adopter. They had something that was very old and outdated. They went through a very deep due diligence process and came up with a new replacement that was very easily 5, if not 10 times better. They launched it, you know, stood back and said, okay, this is great. You know, our customers are going to love this. And nobody noticed. And so they, well, how could this be? This is literally 5 to 10 times better than what we had before. And it was little things like, well, how did we communicate it, right? We ask, well, you know, what? Tell me about launch. What was that like? Well, we sent an email. Yes, and oh, we sent an email. Okay, could we see the email? My partner Jason, again, he's always has so many quotables that he said it was the ungodly love child between compliance and IT. Right, the headline was something that just screamed "delete me," and it was a wall of text on, you know, think what, you know, what you need to know about your bank XYZ mobile banking account. And instead what they ended up doing was some A/B testing and getting a little creative and how do we explain to customers why this is so much better. And it took a few months, but eventually they got that adoption to what they were looking for. So it's not just, you know, hey, choose the best vendor and, you know, execute your project management skills, which banks are usually pretty darn good at. It's do that and make sure that we're aiming for the right target.
You work with a lot of innovation heads of digital and other champions of innovation within Alloy Labs. How do you help them get buy-in from the leaders who are skeptical without really relying on buzzwords or, you know, abstract visions?
Yeah. I mean, the shortest answer I can give you is show, don't tell. But there's a much longer answer behind that, because it is the difficulty, and it's so easy in so many institutions. The decision makers, those with control over the budget, haven't been involved in the customer research. They haven't been involved in the prototypes and the testing. And so they're relying on that to be translated up to them. And the default mode is always no. Nobody ever got in trouble for saying no. No one was ever held accountable for that decision that we didn't do, right? It's fear of messing up, not fear of messing or missing out, right? It's FOMO. And so you have to show them, look, here's what we've done. We've tested it in a small scale, and taking those little steps, like we just talked about, we can't go from, hey, we talked to 10 customers, this looks good, or we even talked to one customer. That might have been those micro insights, as we call them, can be really, really valuable, but there's a lot of steps to go in between before you get to the launch. And so involving them and showing them, along the way is really important. The other thing I would add to that is, somebody needs to be accountable for the decision. It can't be a committee, because everybody wants to be consulted. Nobody wants to be accountable. And so, you know, again, back to the small I incentives, somebody needs to be accountable, not only for spending the money, but for getting the results, and get them invested in it and say, okay, no, I got it. I believe in it. And I'm going to put, again, not just the financial resources, but the managerial time and attention to making sure that this is successful.
So let's fast forward 18 months. What does growth mode look like for commercial banks who take action now?
You know, we've been calling it OS banking. I don't know if that's exactly the right word that's going to stick, right? Operating system. Alex Johnson wrote a piece several weeks ago now. He called small business operating system. So maybe we just stole it from him and didn't make it any better. But he, while we were doing our research, he came out with that piece, and it was really helpful in understanding that, you know, let's take somebody like Intuit, Quicken, QuickBooks. You know, yes, it's an accounting platform, and businesses use it to keep track of their income statement and their balance sheet. But once you're there at that level, there is so much more. You've got a lot of data, so they're lending money. I just saw this week, AutoBooks just opened up a lending platform. They've got $1 million out already because they're looking at that. You know, Amazon is doing this. When you are really understanding the moving parts, you know, as a bank, we're typically getting very old financial statements, typically in paper, right? And saying, okay, even though on the investment side, we'll say past performance is no guarantee of future performance, that's pretty much still how we underwrite. And we're trying to make those decisions. So it's about being embedded. There's a lot of talk about embedded finance, and that's part of it. But also just being embedded in the workflows of the customers. Jobs to be done. I just can't say those words enough, right? Customers have jobs to be done. They can't always articulate them really well to you. Hey, banker, I have this job to be done, and you know, I have this pain I'm trying to avoid. You have to discover that by being really, you know, connected to what they're doing. You know, let's go back to Ramp as an example. When we were doing our research, my wife carries a Ramp card because she works at an independent school. And so I called up the controller of the school and said, hey, just curious, tell me about your process of how did you decide to do this? And she described the pain points that they were trying to solve with customer reimbursements and making sure, or employee reimbursements, and making sure that employees are getting the receipts in and they're spending it on the things that they're allowed and all of that. And I happen to know that their bank offers almost, if not every last thing that Ramp does, but it wasn't top of mind for them. The bank didn't mention it to them, didn't offer it to them. And so now Ramp is there, you know, X number of employees have a Ramp card and they're being marketed to for Ramp. They've got a high yield savings account now at 4.something%. And, you know, that wedge of solving a particular problem or a job to be done and then expanding from there. So it's embedding yourselves in the operations of your customers. And boy, that sounds intrusive, right? I don't mean, you know, embedded like a journalist, right? But understanding what that is, because that's what's happening where the technology companies are winning in this place. And banks can't win if we're this disconnected third party. Oh, I got to go to my bank and open up a bank account or apply for a loan. That burden is becoming far too high compared to what's available to them by so many other competitors.
Yeah, absolutely. A retailer can not even think about, let's get a loan, when Amazon just comes to you and says, hey, we have a loan for you, right?
Yeah, we see what's coming in, what's going out. We see what your turn looks like. You know, looks like this is a slow part of your season. You know, would you like some cash to bridge you in until the next set of sales? Oh, yes. Yeah, if we have a minute, I'll give you another consumer analogy that, you know, has taken place long ago. And, you know, because we've seen this movie before, right? We've seen it in so many other things. I mean, think about the auto loan business. You know, my wife, when she bought her first car, went to her credit union where her dad worked and applied and got approved for an amount. And then, you know, she had a piece of paper. She went to a car dealership and said, this is what I can afford. Right? That business is all gone. It's all indirect now. Many banks have moved out of it completely. So we can't compete. We can't do the volume. We can't compete with the margins. It has become a major profit center for the car dealerships. That's an example of embedded or OS, right? It's involved in the operating system of selling a car to a consumer. Is that finance is seamless in that. And the same thing is happening now. As William Gibson said about the future, it's already here. It's just not widely distributed yet. It's happening. It's not coming 10 years from now, right? It's happening and we have to respond.
So, you know, we look forward, let's look back a little bit. So, you know, you spent 20 years inside a bank that grew from 6 billion to 400 billion. If you were back inside today at a bank, what would you focus on first?
Maybe it's what I said a few minutes ago about being clear about separating internal improvements versus things that customers really value. I think I would spend a lot more time talking to customers. It's easy. You know, I love going to shows like Finovate and Money 2020 and seeing all the cool things out there. And sometimes that's helpful. Sometimes that's really helpful. Maybe you already know the problem you're trying to solve, or maybe you go, oh, I hadn't thought of that before. But sometimes we can get anchored on this solution. And then now I got to go sell this solution to my customers. And I think I have learned over the years, and if I could go back, I would be even more focused on defining it from the customer's perspective, not just about, oh, hey, here's a cool piece of technology that we could use, because most customers don't care. Some do, but most don't. And really thinking about how do we do that? And, you know, I would have liked to have, had Jason around to come up with FIRE that many years ago, right? A systematic, repeatable process to test and learn and tighten those iteration loops. Because I think also in the early days, we spent way too long on a lot of these pilots. And so trying to understand, well, what is it that we're trying to learn? How important is it? The sweet spot is, what are you most uncertain about? And what would be most game-changing to understand, right? Is it a go, no-go decision? Is it, you know, life changing? If you can try to figure that out, and you can't always do it up front, sometimes you have to go along a few steps before you figure that out. But sometimes we solve the easy problems instead of the critical ones. And like, oh yeah, customers like this in blue instead of red. Okay, who cares, right?
I think this kind of leads to the next question I had for you. But if you had to pick one mindset shift every commercial banking exec needs to make, what would it be?
I think it's really redefining what their job is. And many of them, as I said earlier, value the relationship they have with customers, and that's wonderful, right? Having a customer focus is good. But how you deliver value to your customers and the things you deliver to your customers. A great many banks still, when we talk about the commercial side of the bank, they still are and are called commercial lenders, right? Not relationship managers. Some are, right? So some have already moved on to this. Some have put kind of teams around here. And again, we've seen this movie before too. This is what we've done with small business service centers. This is what we've done in wealth management, where there are specialists who understand certain products and services and, you know, workflows and jobs to be done, and being able to surround them for the customer. I worked with a bank many years ago that was putting in new technology to help their investment portfolio managers. And it made their jobs immensely easier. And the 10% of them who got it said, oh my gosh, this is the best thing ever. Because now I come in, I spend about an hour with this piece of technology over a cup of coffee, and I make all the movements in my customers' portfolios that I need to make. And then I spend the rest of my day talking to my customers about the moves that we made and why, or, you know, trying to grow the business and talk to more customers. But good 90% of the portfolio managers defined their job as selecting securities. That's not what the bank thought their job was. They had their own side Excel spreadsheets where they were calculating ratios and, you know, portfolio optimization. The bank said, no, we're already doing that at the top level. Your job is to really manage that relationship. And I know in many banks, the same thing is happening on the credit side. You know, I'm a relationship manager, but what I spend 80% of my time doing is, you know, verifying the documents and recalculating the ratios and, you know, trying to, you know, fit into an underwriting box. That's important. That needs to get done. But that is that the job that we really need to put around the human being? So it's really rethinking, you know, where do you add value in your job?
Makes me think of how some banks are organized, and in the commercial world, if you're, the entry level for a commercial banker used to be, or perhaps still is in many places, is you come in as a someone with a degree in finance, and you spend a ton of time just spreading financials. That's all you do. And you do that for many years. Then you move up to be a portfolio manager, and then you're working with a relationship manager on portfolios, and you're doing some of the things that you just mentioned. Eventually, you graduate to be your own relationship manager, and now you have accounts, and now you're out there playing golf with your clients and all of that. But spreading financials doesn't necessarily prepare you to be a relationship manager, right? And so what you're saying makes a lot of sense. And we just don't even think of, you know, how do we teach a new person that we hire in our commercial lending world to be a relationship manager, a true partner to the business, a true partner to a company that's looking at the bank. So that makes a lot of sense to me.
And I would add to that, you know, and many really do have really good personal relationships with them, but then there's this massive gulf in between those two things, right? They have a great relationship and they golf and they have lunch and all that kind of stuff. And then there's all this doing the job that we've always done on, you know, checking the spreads and all that kind of stuff. And there's so much in between of how do we leverage that relationship and to not just, hey, how are the kids? And, you know, is there anything else I can lend you? But starting to understand, again, those jobs to be done, and how do we tie that into more products? And it's, you know, one of our bank member CFOs said, not all of my customers need a loan at any given time, but every one of them needs to hold and move money. And we need to get better at what we're offering and how we even have that conversation with them.
Right. How do you find the expense reimbursement to employees, as you were giving an example before, when all you're talking about is, hey, you know, what equipment are you buying, and can we help you buy it? What building are you moving to, and can we help you with that? And you don't get to the details of something like what you were saying before. So that makes a lot of sense. So JP, if our listeners remember just one thing from this episode, what do you want it to be?
Listen, there's a new playbook developing in commercial banking, and they're playing chess while we're still playing checkers, and they're using our own pieces. The window to catch up is closing. You really need to pay attention now to really get in there and understand everything that your customer needs and move beyond just, you know, being a lender to truly being that relationship manager and understanding, you know, how we can help. And that might not be just the products that we have currently on our balance sheet. It might mean more partnerships. It might mean developing new products, either alone or with those partners. It might mean some things that maybe I'm not incented for today, but looking at what are the jobs my customers need to be done? What are the pains they're trying to avoid? What are the gains that they're trying to achieve? And if I can reposition in my mind that my job is to take care of my customer and all of those things, and embracing the fact that technology is going to be a piece of this. You don't have to be a technologist. I've never written a line of code in my life, right? But it's understanding that these pieces of technology are tools. And if I'm going to get better at my craft, I need to use the latest and greatest tools.
So that's it for today's episode of Banking Reinvented, Unlock Growth Mode. Huge thanks to JP for cutting through all the noise. If you're a commercial banking leader ready to simplify complexity and drive real growth, stay tuned. We're just getting started.
You've been listening to Banking Reinvented by Backcase. Be sure to follow us on LinkedIn, where we share key takeaways, exclusive content, and behind-the-scenes perspectives to help your bank lead the charge toward modern growth.